Rocket Talk. I am Justin Landon, and I am the captain of this ship. And I've got two deckhands on the poop deck tonight, which sounds horrible. I will never use that analogy again. I apologize. But I am joined tonight by Mavesh Murad and Jared Shuren. Mavesh is a Tor.com blogger and one of the smartest people in the biz. She's a former radio host. Her show 89 Chapters was until very recently Pakistan's only on-air book show. With the show now canceled, Mavesh is taking her talents to Tor.com, launching the second podcast in the Tor.com network called what, Mavesh?
Midnight in Karachi.
Called Midnight in Karachi. It will surely make this podcast immediately irrelevant.
I'm pretty certain it won't, Justin, but thank you for having me.
Yes, we're very glad to have you. And our other person is Jared Shuren. He is the co-owner and editor of the Hugo and British Fantasy Award-nominated blog Pornokitch. He's the publisher at Jurassic London, my co-editor of the Hugo-nominated and British Fantasy Award-winning Speculative Fiction 2012. He's a trained barbecue judge and the co-host of a comic book podcast called...
One Comic.
Called One Comic, which is bizarre because the last time I checked, Jared, you deeply disliked podcasts.
And yet, here he is.
The things I do for you guys and for myself.
We appreciate them.
But you launched a podcast with other people. Like, you totally weren't into this. Now you're all in.
The agreement was, as long as I don't have to listen to it, because despite all evidence to the contrary, I really can't stand the sound of my own voice.
But I guess if you don't have to edit it or listen to it, you're in the clear.
Absolutely. I do none of the work and get a substantial portion of the fame.
I feel like that's not the case for us, Mavesh. I feel like we do a lot of the work.
Yes, and that's, as you know, one of the things that I was most concerned about is the post-production and the editing, because that's not something I spent much time doing on radio. It's been a steep learning curve, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I still don't know how to do it. I'm still like using like duct tape to just make it show up every week.
Well, if you saw where I was recording, you would actually see a lot of duct tape and blankets on the wall. Blankets from 1966 and 1971. I'm not even joking.
Oh,
that's fantastic. That sounds quite cool. There's a film here in the U.S., and I don't know if it made it to the U.K., Jared, but it's called Hustle and Flow. And it's about a hip-hop artist starring Terrence Howard. And he's obviously living in a rough situation, but he sets up a studio in his house. And to soundproof his booth in the house, he tapes, staples egg cartons to the walls.
That's really clever. I have egg crate mattress on my door. You know the foam mattress that looks like an egg carton?
Yeah.
Kind of goes up and down, wavy? Yeah. I bought a sheet of that to put on the door. It didn't help as much as I thought it would.
You are committed.
Well, I mean, this is the weird part. You move from professional radio to something like this, and suddenly you have all these issues because you're used to sitting in a soundproof studio. And you don't want to compromise, but at some point, I guess you have to because, you know, you're on your own.
I'm not that committed by any means. I sit in my chair and I hope that my children don't start crying in the middle of the episode, which happens from time to time. So I personally am looking forward to the Karachi background noise.
Yeah. Well, I've been trying really hard to block it out continuously. It's an uphill struggle because we do live on a busy road and Karachi buses tend to stop wherever the hell they feel like it. And there are no bus stops and it's a bit Mad Max, all of it. And they're loud and, they don't really care if you have recordings to do. So we're going to have to just, I guess there's either going to be lots of that or I will genuinely be recording at midnight in Karachi and it might just get a tiny bit quieter. Not by much, though.
Well, based on this show, and just so everybody's aware of what we're dealing with here, it is 11 p.m. for me. It is 5 a.m. for Jared and it is 10 a.m. for Mavesh. Is that correct?
And that is correct. And all that means is that Jared is the most committed of all of us.
Also the quietest. Now, I'm very, very flattered to be here.
All right. So, Mavesh, you were launching this podcast, Midnight in Karachi, and I have to say, Jared and I take immense amount of satisfaction that we dragged you in to Tor.com to contribute to Under the Radar, and now you have this show. Like, tell us, like, what do you want to do with Midnight in Karachi? Like, what's the vision?
Yeah, that's a big question. Firstly, immensely grateful to both of you for introducing me to Tor, who are, and I'm not saying this because this is a Tor podcast, they genuinely are fantastic people to work with. I've never worked with such organized and specific and open-minded people before. It's brilliant. And it's weird because one of the things I've realized recently while I've been writing for Tor and simultaneously also writing for the local literary supplement Books and Authors, it's a weekly supplement with our biggest English language newspaper in here, Pakistan, I've realized I'm able to be a lot more open with Tor. And I was mentioning this to Jared recently, is that you realize after years of local, sort of doing radio in Pakistan and writing for Pakistani supplements, primarily, you realize now, or I realize now, that I, in some ways, have been self-censoring a great deal. And I haven't been able to, I guess, talk about a lot of things that I'd want to do or talk about things openly as much as I wanted to, which I think I can now do. So I'm genuinely hoping to still have, to be able to talk to writers about also, not just writers, but people sort of related to books in all sorts of ways that I couldn't before. It might sound really selfish that I'm more concerned about what I can and cannot do, but I think it moves me in the direction of a more open dialogue, which is probably helpful not just to an international audience, but also to who may have been my audience in Pakistan before with the radio show.
Jared, you've been listening to Mavesh's show for quite a while, right? 89 chapters?
Absolutely. Lauren Bukas, actually, I think was not one of your early guests, Mavesh, but she was on, what, 2 years ago?
For the first time, yeah, but Lauren's a repeat offender. She's been on three times. Had been on three times.
She you know, did this recording, she got to pick the music, she got to talk about her book, she said they were the best questions she'd ever been asked, and everyone should start tuning in. And Mavesh is kind of a now like a cult figure in London. Soon we were all tuning in.
That's so weird for me to hear. But thank you.
Oh, you were such a celebrity when you showed up here for WorldCon and everyone got to see you in person. It was so exciting.
More for me probably, but still.
I think we talk about your 89 chapters a lot, but you know, there's also the tragedy of losing your blues show.
Yes, there was. Yeah, Voodoo Nights. That was the show I think Jared was more interested in, because we both share a love for the blues, even though we may not agree on all the bands that I played. But no, that was more music based, and I think that's. Yeah, it's weird because I'm not feeling the loss of the show in terms of losing the ability to talk to writers, because I'm really glad that I can still do that. You know, also there's Twitter. But I do kind of miss being able to play the music and getting a reaction for that. That is strange.
Yeah, music and podcasting is a real challenge. These things called like licenses are a real pain in the ass. So 89 Chapters is canceled recently, which is obviously a horrible decision by your program director or whoever made that decision. But your last guest was George R. R. Martin, and they canceled you, and you had George in the can. Like, what the hell?
Yeah, well, you know, there was a joke on the radio station's Facebook page that George R. R. Martin is known for killing all his characters, but now he's killed the radio show as well. But of course, it wasn't his fault. And I have Justin to thank for meeting George R. R. Martin at Worldcon, which was, as I will always, always say, that it was the slickest, smoothest introduction ever made in the history of introductions, Justin, because I thought you knew George Martin. I thought you were best friends with him. Little did I know that you were not. But ever grateful for that.
Yeah, that was a fun experience. We were at the I guess it was like the Tor Joe Fletcher party. Jared, you were there.
Yeah.
I was just watching in stunned silence.
So I have met George before. He has no earthly idea who I am. And I just, Mavesh wanted to have him on the show, and so I said, and I'd had a drink or two, and I said, Mavesh, come on over. I'll introduce you to George. Come on. So we just walk up to him and I said, George, this is Mavesh Murad, and she is a big deal in Pakistan and you should talk to her. And so they talked and he agreed to come on her show. And then after the interview, I said, oh, George, my name's Justin. Nice to meet you. And you should have seen the look on Mavesh's face.
Yeah, I don't think I could. Yeah, I really couldn't keep myself composed at that point. I was kind of, I was shocked.
He's such a nice man.
And impressed. He was lovely. He was absolutely lovely. And he spoke to me for well over an hour. And all the things that people didn't hear in the show were the things that he was asking me about Pakistan and publishing in Pakistan and, you know, what it was like growing up here and stories about my life here, which is amazing when someone who genuinely you know, wants to know more about something they don't. And I've encountered people before who like to pretend that they know everything about everything. And this was not a man like that. He was just very, there's a lot of humility in him accepting that there were parts of the world he didn't know enough about and he wanted to know more about, which is wonderful, really.
Do you have the raw audio from that still?
Yeah.
You should air the full thing. That would be really cool.
Unfortunately, what it means is when you record a show for a radio station and you're under contract with them, they have ownership of it. Yeah, I know. I don't own it. I mean, I have the backups, but that's about it.
Oh, that's too bad. It's, cause that's one of the most interesting thing about, you know, interviewing and podcasting is it becomes far more compelling when it gets into that organic discussion. And unfortunately, it doesn't happen as often. I mean, especially over Skype and things like this, because you don't have that in-person experience that you can get, you know, when you have somebody in studio, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes a while. I've always felt with every Skype interview, when it's one-on-one, it's a little easier. For example, right now, there's three of us, and I think we're all fairly conscious of not speaking over the other person. It's a little easier when it's two people. And I mean, I was doing it for a while, so I always felt like there was this one point that you had to kind of push past when the other person was comfortable enough to sort of let the conversation go in a more organic direction. It just takes a little while, I guess, for every conversation.
Now, Jared, you've been doing your show, one comic. Are you only reading one comic?
Ever. One yes, comic that, ever.
That's right. We're going to do this panel by panel and eventually reach the final page.
Oh, so it's like a tour.com reread.
Yes. After which we will actually do the reread of one comic.
Excellent.
And then some discussions. One comic is actually the brainchild of John Morgan, who is a very experienced podcaster and also sort of a walking version of the Marvel Encyclopedia. And he just wanted to experiment with this idea where we took a single issue of a comic and just poked at it for about 20 minutes, a half an hour. To see what fell out. And he, Rebecca Levine and I, we're all good friends. We've known one another for over a decade. I think John and Bex go back even further. We certainly have no fear about talking over one another. We gather once a week, pick a comic. Generally, we hope it's a good one, and then just tear it apart for half an hour. It's surprisingly fun. I'm not an experienced podcaster or even an experienced comics reader, and it's been very educational in both senses.
Do you drink during it?
No.
It's interesting because I was when I heard you doing when you were doing a comics podcast, I thought to myself, who the fuck has time to read comic books? Because I mean, not that they take a long time to read, but man, we got to read a lot of other stuff too.
That's absolutely true. I have to say, it's been really fun because I have not consistently gone into comic book shops for a long, long time. And this has given me a reason to sort of embrace doing that again, of going in and just looking at all these really brightly colored, very exciting things that are all neatly arrayed on a shelf and sort of poking at each one of them until one of them, you know, leaps off and says, you should pay £4 for me, and then talk about me in excruciating detail. And that's what happens now.
My daughter's super into Black Widow, so when I was in New York City for the tour.com launch party, I picked up a Black Widow trade comic book graphic novel thing, and I've been trying to read it to her, and I get really angry because the storytelling is so bad, and I just like, I want to like lecture her about it, but she loves it. I'm like, this is stupid. But anyway, I'm sure
Justin,
other comics are much better.
Justin, I have a question. Mm. Do you drink during podcasts?
I don't. Not usually. I should. I mean,
I'm just asking. I'm not sure about the should part, but.
I mean, I feel like I'm gregarious enough that perhaps I don't need further.
Dutch courage, yeah.
Yeah, further lubrication, I guess you could say. No, I don't. But so Jared references going into comic book shops, and this interests me about you, Mahvesh, because living in Pakistan, and I've heard you talk about this a lot on Twitter and other places, is like genre fiction is not widely available in Karachi or anywhere in Pakistan. So,
well, no, I mean, that's changing in the last, I would say, 5 years or so. But you know, a lot's changed in the last decade anyway. When I grew up, sure, there weren't any official bookstores. You would go into the bazaars and you would buy secondhand books. I don't know, left behind on the hippie trail some decades ago. I have no idea how they even got here. A lot of stuff I picked up in Karachi's bazaars, you know, turned around eventually and informed a great deal of what I think about fiction in general and narratives now. People like Ian Banks, people like Graham Joyce, I mean, what were those books doing here? I have no idea. How do they get here? I have no clue. But they did, and I was grateful for them. Dragonlance. I saw it, you know, recently again in Karachi's bazaars, and I'm so grateful that decades later it's still there. I'm going to ruin some other young person's mind forever. It's changed now in the last 10 years. A lot has changed in Pakistan for good and bad in the last 10 years. But now we've got a couple of sort of smaller independent bookstores, and even the big chains are realizing that, for example, young adult fiction and a certain kind of science fiction are very popular in Pakistan. I mean, all those years of doing the show and talking to all these people who would text in and call in, the things that were most popular were crime novels or thrillers and high fantasy, which I kept saying make complete sense if you're living in Pakistan, that those two would be the most favorite things. So it has changed a lot. It was difficult when I was growing up. It was difficult to get a hold of stuff. But then you had things like, you know, my father owned a copy of Lord of the Rings, because everyone owned a copy of Lord of the Rings everywhere in the world, everyone who read English. And that kind of is a gateway. You then go out and look for stuff on aunts and uncles' bookshelves and in bazaars, hoping that you find something else that made you feel that way. And of course, we have a very rich heritage of fantasy in our own storytelling culture, which is stuff you grew up with, your parents, you know, stories your parents telling you.
Did I hear you mention in there that Dragonlance was important to you?
Oh, yeah. You don't know. Jared and I are doing a Dragonlance reread for Tor in January.
I like you so much more now. I mean, I liked you before, but like, I like you.
Oh, thanks.
More.
If I'd only known, I would have mentioned this earlier. It was. Dragonlance was. And I mean, I think I probably might have read it slightly more later than, say, you guys did. I mean, I admit, I was like 16 when I read it, because that's when I found it. That's when I found these books in a bazaar in Karachi. And yeah, that was it. And suddenly it was all, whoa, where did this come from? Because it was high fantasy, but as Jared pointed out to me maybe about a year or so ago, really badly written, but just so gripping, you know, in so many ways.
You're never too old to read Dragonlance for the first time.
I think I read it the seventh time when I was 16, which...
Yeah, that feels about right, doesn't it?
Which is perfectly reasonable to me. I tried to reread it recently, and I couldn't do it, so...
Well, we're going to do it for you.
That's right.
This is like a great announcement. Like, the Dragonlance reread is coming.
Yeah, it is, it is. And we're going to be very brave about it, and I still, can I just say, for all my saying that bookstores have improved massively in the last few years, I still had to go onto a secondhand bookstore website and order a copy of Dragonlance because my sister wouldn't give me hers. So yeah, I still had to look for a secondhand copy, but you know, Jared and I are ready and, you know, guns ablaze and all the rest of it.
I'm trying to think if there's any book in the world I have bought and abandoned more than the Dragonlance Chronicles. Like, I think, you know, I must have, every time I've moved, every time I've sort of like aged 6 months or something, I think I've gone back and tried to read it and sort of read it and then ditched that copy at a used bookstore. And then just sort of the cycle has repeated. So I've probably touched like every copy in the world by now. So I hope you enjoy my old copy.
I was just going to say that your copies are probably in, you know, Itwar Bazaar in Karachi. That's probably where people are buying
them
from.
That would make me so happy.
I'm going to go looking in the inside, see if you've signed your name in any of them.
Mm.
The amazing things about those books is that the first three chapters in Solace to Flint trying to get into the river, you know, and getting like hypothermia and he leaves the river. And like, they're on their adventure, like in 5,000 words, like the adventure is on. And I remember as a kid thinking that like this lead up, this introduction was so rich. And like, now I go back and read it and I'm like, God damn, my imagination filled in a lot of blanks.
Yeah.
Like, there's not much there.
It'll be an interesting exercise to see if that happens again right now. I think Jared might have even read them more recently than I did. I haven't read them since I was 17. So it's really going to be a sort of a new angle for me completely. I have never read them as an adult. I've never read them as a more educated adult. So let's see how much I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for.
Jared, will you be diagramming sentences?
Let's see. Yes, I think so. I'm sure we can even sneak in like an infographic or two.
Talk to the Tor.com production staff. I'm sure they would love to do infographics.
Or we could just make little drawings and, you know, upload JPEGs of horrible little drawings.
Well, I don't know what your 16-year-old reading experience was like, but I'm sure I've got my own Dragonlance fan art somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Undoubtedly. So now that we're through the introduction to this episode, now would be a great time to talk about our best of the year and, like, what books, you know, we're at the end of 2014. I know Jared and I get a lot of advanced copies, so if something came out in December, we've probably already seen it. So what are the best reads of the year that the fair listeners of Rocket Talk can go forth and find? And Jared, I want to start with you. I don't want you to give the whole list because that would be really bad podcasting. but give me like two books. Let's start with like two books and let's see if we can fight about something.
Can I back into this a tiny bit?
Yeah, back. Oh, please. This is
because I was thinking about this. You did give us some warning that we were going to be put on the spot like this. And I think if someone had told me a few years ago or even last year that, you know, 2014, there was going to be no new KJ Parker, no China Mieville, no Patrick Ness, no Scott Lynch. You know, Joe Abercrombie would be writing a kid's book. No George R. R. Martin. You know, if someone had just gone through the list and been like, Jared, all those authors that you know, scribble in your calendar, they're all taking the year off. I would have been really very upset and really had a bad view of the year. But looking back on this and sort of taking notes on 2014, this may have been the best year for genre fiction for a long, long time. I mean, absolutely amazing stuff came out this year, and coming up with best of lists is really hard.
Mm-hmm. I've got 15 books on here and on my list, and I feel really good about all 15 of them. You know, like I don't think I could easily pick the best out of that list. And I'm missing a lot of books that I know were amazing that I just didn't get to.
Absolutely. I mean, when we were sort of comparing notes already, you guys were saying quite a few books that I'd just not gotten to. And this isn't even counting things like, you know, David Mitchell and Murakami, like who are, right. I'm, no, have written amazing things that I just haven't even picked up off the shelf yet.
I have started The Bone Clocks.
And I want to know what you think of it when you're done, because I know people have been really divided about it. I really liked it.
The first chapter, I mean, I've just started the first chapter, and I'm already, like, deeply disturbed, because the first chapter is really hard to read, I think. As a parent, like, it's really hard to read.
Oh, in that way, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that the initial voice, the first voice he uses of the teenage girl is possibly the most effective one for me in that book.
No, it's really
having been a teenage girl. Yeah,
it's really good. It's just I'm just like, I have a 5-year-old girl, and I'm like, is she gonna think that way? Like, it was a little frightening. But all right, Jared, throw some books at us. Throw me a book.
Nick Harkaway, Tiger Man. Absolutely great. His most linear book so far, and it's about superheroes, and it's near future, and it's about parenthood, and it's about action, and Harkaway has that knack of making the future and making weird technology really accessible and really fun and really entertaining, and wrapping that all up with very emotive, empathetic characters. Definitely one of the best of the year.
I've read Nick Harkaway's early books as well, and he just really gets progressively better with every one, which I know is a silly thing to say almost, but not every writer does. And you can, I think, sense in his work the effort that's going in. He knows he needs to get better. He knows he wants to get better. And that kind of development just means a lot more to me when you see that the writer has made this immense effort to be better and deeper in every way. It sort of makes me enjoy the book even more, knowing that they've put in that effort. This was his most, I felt, emotionally sound book as well, most well-developed emotionally. I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, I shamefully admit I've not read Harkaway yet. Mavesh, give me one. What do you got?
Lagoon, Nadia Okorafor.
Absolutely gorgeous.
I had a hard time getting started in it. She has a very unique prose style, I find.
Really? I think, you know, I love that. I think she's really fun. I genuinely think she's one of those people who just says, you know what, I'm going to enjoy myself in every word. And she does. She doesn't seem to care that she has to hold back or restrain herself in any way. She takes this particular genre that I don't even want to use the word genre, the style that she has. I think she really relishes in it. And I do too when she writes that. It's an alien invasion story. It's set in Lagos in Nigeria. And, you know, for those of us who grew up thinking aliens would only invade New York or LA or Paris or London, it's fantastic. It really is. It's just, you see sort of a third world city and you see how people there would react and in certain ways survive better, in certain ways do worse things or whatever it is. It's different, I suppose. Every person's vision is different. For me, I don't know, I guess I related to that a lot more living in Karachi. Lagos seemed a lot like Karachi, I'll tell you that.
And what you say about every person's vision is different, it's also true within the book as well. I mean, her ability to switch voices and switch perspectives to some really fascinating ones is absolutely brilliant. It's a really gorgeous book.
Yeah. And it is, you're right, Justin, it's a very, very particular style of prose. And it's not, I've read some of her earlier work and some of her other stories, and it's not the same style that she uses every single time. But I really enjoy that kind of, the kind of freeness that she has in Lagoon with the prose in Lagoon. And I also think that she, let me just say, I mean, Jared won't be able to say because he's involved personally with the editor. But can I just say that I think it's a fantastic editor who lets a writer just do all of this and be this free with prose.
The book that I'm going to recommend first is Smiler's Fair by the aforementioned Rebecca Levine, which is also acquired by that same editor. And it's, to me, it's like the perfect epic fantasy. I mean, it does all the things I like about epic fantasy and none of the shit I don't like about epic fantasy. It's very similar to sort of like what Daniel Abraham does here, but I think it's much more sharp and concise than Daniel Abraham's work can be. The only thing I could negatively say about it is that there's not much resolved. I mean, it's just a long prologue, but that's fine with me. I mean, I loved the ride.
Me too. I mean, by far the best epic fantasy of the year and probably the best epic fantasy I've read in some time. And I am so excited that it is the first of four books because I'm ready. That is absolutely the sort of thing I'm very ready to commit to for the long haul.
I am in agreement with you both. That's all I'll say.
Now, Jared, you and I have both read The City of Stairs by Robert Jackson Bennett, and I know Mavesh has kind of tried to start it, but hasn't.
A false start, let's call it that.
Yes, a false start. Like I had with Lagoon, kind of the same experience, I would guess. And, I mean, I think it's a phenomenal novel. I mean, I'm a unabashed Robert Jackson Bennett fan. I've read everything he's written, and I think he's phenomenal. But this feels like, to me, him writing, it's like Robert Jackson Bennett, but a more accessible novel to fantasy readers.
I am also, I think I've been converted into a diehard fan, and I love that he switches genres with every book and just shows that he can address the sort of the core tropes and the core plots of every genre, but in an absolutely unique and stylized and very, very interesting way. And, you know, City of Stairs is like a post-fantasy fantasy. You know, it's fantasy after the good guys won and the evil empire lost, but it's so much more than that, and it shows you what happens after the curtain falls.
Well, it's like the good guys becoming sort of enamored with their own power and thus becoming the bad guys.
It's the bureaucracy of the lawful good empire.
Right. And to me, it's also almost like a Le Carré novel in that there's this, the main character is a spy and she's like running a spy op. It's not an action oriented fantasy novel. I mean, it's a cloak and dagger fantasy novel.
It is. But somehow at the same time, he has such rich world building and such honestly kick-ass fight scenes, that just sort of sneak in there. And this is not a fat book by any means. This is just sort of an ordinary book sized book that somehow is, as you say, at its heart sort of a political espionage novel, but somehow does some really, really, really badass fantasy as well.
All right, what else you got, Jared?
You stole one of mine, so I'm going to steal one of Mavesh's. Megan Abbott's The Fever.
Oh! She's my, like, biggest writer crush right now. She really is. Why have I not read her before this year? 2014 was a better year for my discovery of Megan Abbott.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same way. I stumbled on, I think, Dare Me at the start of the year, maybe late last year, and then just, you know, hunted down her entire back catalog. But The Fever, it's about high school in sort of a small American town, and a mysterious illness starts striking people down, and it's how the community reacts to it. And I hope there is a long and passionate discussion about whether this even qualifies as genre fiction, much less science fiction. To me, it's science fiction without the overtly impossible element to it, but it's people reacting to the apocalypse. It's people reacting to the end of the world, to something mysterious and uncontrollable. And it's just beautiful and horrifying and intimate and all of those things that Megan Abbott just excels at doing.
Absolutely. I mean, ditto in every single way. She's just incredible. She has this lean, taut kind of noir way of writing that I want to read those sentences again and again because they're like very, very heavy cloud. And yet, you know, it's cloud, so it's not weighing down on you. This is a terrible analogy, but I hope you understand. It's literally like that. It's just holding back so much feeling and emotion and so much thought and so much potential. I mean, her language is just, her skills are just amazing. Also, she's going to be on Midnight in Karachi, so I cannot wait to tell her all of this myself. I will be gushing, let me warn you. But fantastic. I'm in agreement with Jared all the way. The Fever is definitely one of my favorite books, and she's just the best thing I've discovered this year. She really is.
The Three by Sarah Lotz, and you mentioned that this in The Fever, it's about this science fictional element and these people in these small towns reacting to this stimulus and how they handle it. And I think The Three is the same way. Like, I don't know that it's terribly genre either. And I will argue till I'm blue in the face that it doesn't matter if it's a supernatural book. It's this horrifying story about how people react to tragic events. And, like, that book rocked me for that reason, because I found the reaction of people to those tragic events the most horrifying part of the book.
Totally agree.
Absolutely. I think it does work the same way. I mean, they're both very different books. Yeah. I wouldn't compare them as books, but I understand what you mean. Sorry, we're speaking over each other. Jared, you go.
One of the interesting things about The Three is that I know, just what you were saying, Justin, it's gotten feedback, both positive and negative, about the way that Sarah Lotz addresses the sort of Christian fundamentalist points of view in it. Some people say she's too tall, she's too kind and too soft, and some people say she's too mean and too tough to them, which to me sounds like she got it absolutely perfect.
I'm trying to agree without repeating what you guys have said, but yeah, I do think she got it just right. And I'm actually also very interested in seeing the next book, because I know it's not quite related to this. I've read some of her earlier stuff, and with when she wrote as part of S.L. Grey, and I like those books a great deal as well. But The Three is, I think, really her coming into herself. I mean, this particular genre of neither here nor there seems to suit her really well.
Her next book, from what I've heard, is, you know, just as absolutely fantastic. And when either of you undoubtedly have her on as a guest, you have to ask her about her research for it, because she, amongst other things, had to go on a singles cruise.
That's fantastic.
That's awesome. I had her on earlier this year, but I'll have to have her back again at some point. That's cool.
We're going to have to fight about this, Justin, because I had her on my show as well, and I want her back on.
Ooh, crossover podcast.
Yeah, that's probably... Well, I'm not going to have a physical fight with you, but, you know.
All right, Bob.
Because I'll just win that.
Give me a book.
Well, one of the books that isn't, as we're talking about, not quite genre, one that isn't genre at all, but written by someone who's known for genre writing, is The Girls at the Kingfisher Club by Genevieve Valentine. And she wrote Mécanique, which I also liked a great deal. It was about like a steampunk circus a couple of years ago. And The Girls at the Kingfisher Club is a jazz age story, basically the fairy tale of the 12 dancing princesses set in the jazz age, but without any most obvious sort of magic. It's about sisterhood and relationships of, you know, a group of women within one family. It's fantastic. It's really well written. It's so charming in so many ways. And as much as it wasn't, you know, outrightly genre, it just had this very fairy tale magical feel about it that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, Valentine is one of the writers I need to get to at some point. I have Mécanique on my shelf, but I haven't had a chance to read it. And The Girl at the Kingfisher Club totally it was out for several months before I even knew it existed. I think probably because it didn't get marketed at all to genre circles, so I just never saw it.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things that didn't get, I think, marketed in the genre circles is a book that I really enjoyed as well called The Girl in the Road by a writer called Monica Byrne. I think it's her first book. And it's, I think Jared and I might have had a conversation about this. I mean, the blurbs on the back are so from Neil Gaiman and John Scalzi and, you know, people who are genre, you know, big names in genre fiction. And yet, I don't know why it wasn't sort of marketed within the genre circles. It's actually really, really good. I highly recommend that to everyone as well.
Jared, you got another book?
I think just, you know, going back to past Jared to sort of continue that terrible theme. If you had told me my favorite book of the year was not just going to be self-published, but also created through Kickstarter, I don't even know how I would have reacted. But Becky Chambers, The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, is just about the most perfect science fiction novel I may have ever read. It's just astounding. It's lovely, and I mean that not in a dismissive way, but it's optimistic, it's warm, it's a happy book that makes you just feel better about the world and the fate of humanity after reading it. And it's just it's an adventure book. It's a spaceship filled with an odd cast of characters, going from point A to point B, which is in fact a small angry planet, and encountering lots of strange things along the way. But it's just absolutely heartwarming, and it's progressive without being worthy, and it's just lovely. I cannot recommend it highly enough.
I first heard about Becky Chambers from Joe Monty, the editor at Saga Press, and he said, we were talking back and forth about being at LunCon, and he said, oh man, you know, my friend Becky Chambers is going to be there. She wrote this book. It's phenomenal. You have to meet her. And I don't know if that's how you met. Did you meet her at LunCon, Jared?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Book Smugglers introduced us and said, hey, this is Becky Chambers. She's very nice. She blogs. And she was such a nice person. And after WorldCon, I went and introduced myself to her on Twitter, and then discovered that she had a website and discovered that she had a book. So I just sort of got it on a whim. And wow, I'm glad I did.
Yeah, I need to check it out. I actually have bought it on my Kindle, so I'm going to be reading that one here pretty soon. Mavesh said something earlier about, I guess it was Megan Abbott, about how her sentences are tight but also carry like this great weight. And that reminded me of my favorite writer. And you say there was no KJ Parker this year, Jared, but there was. And it's Academic Exercises, the KJ Parker collection. And although it's kind of cheating because none of the novellas in the collection actually came out this year, but look, man, in terms of like my bang for my buck on a paragraph by paragraph basis, KJ Parker is the cat's pajamas.
He's been another good discovery for me in 2014, thanks to you guys.
So brilliant, and I'm glad Academic Exercises exists, because as Parker started, I guess, dabbling in short stories or whatever, they've just been scattered all over the internet and in different volumes and things like that. And Academic Exercises, I mean, you talk about bang for the buck, it's what, like 700 pages long? And it's just wall-to-wall Parker, and Parker is amazing.
Yeah, and it fills in a lot of the blanks from the novels. Like, Parker's novels are always so mundane in a lot of ways. They tend to find amazing stories in the mundaneness of life. And it's like in smelting something, or in, you know, deciding that your legal practice is in the tank. I mean, that's like a KJ Parker novel. But the novellas have a lot more fantasy to them, a lot more whimsy to them, I think, ethereal quality at times. And I think it's exciting as a KJ Parker reader, because all of Parker stuff is set in the same world.
I think so too. And I like, as you say, you know, Parker's novels will have six chapters on smelting. There's this interesting sort of reversal where, like, the novels will take something incredibly boring, sorry to any smelters that might be listening, but make it fascinating. And then the short stories almost work in reverse, where Parker will take, like, magic, and they'll be featuring wizards, and the supernatural will be sort of reduced to the utterly mundane and boring.
Right.
And it's a really interesting balance between them. But, you know, Parker's the best in the field. So
One of the stories, I can't remember the actual name of the story, but it's about a wizard whose job is to read the minds of dogs to determine whether or not they have disease or not. And reads the minds of like 1,000 dogs a day. I mean, it's just absurd. Okay. Mavesh, you got something?
Well, here's a writer who I discovered this year again, and somebody who's just making a buzz now. And I bring this up, yes, I'm biased because he is Pakistani, and there aren't many Pakistanis writing this kind of genre fiction. He's a doctor in Florida, but he's from Lahore, Pakistan. His name's Usman T. Malik, and his story, Resurrection Points on Strange Horizons, was tweeted a lot, written about a lot, and people talked about it. I read it, and I was very interested. I had, you know, some things I liked about it, some things I didn't. But I went out there and looked for other work that he's done, and he contacted me, I think, on Facebook. saying, you know, obviously we should be in touch. This is what I write. And I thought, okay, this guy's, you know, he seems to be trying really hard to break into the community, which I suppose is difficult for new short story writers. He's a graduate of Clarion. And a particular story that I want to mention that I really, really liked, and so much so that I've offered to do the audio narration for it, and I want to get it on Midnight in Karachi as a story for one particular episode. I'm not certain that's happening, but we're going to work out the legalities, or Tora will work out the legalities. The story is called The Vaporization Enthalpy of a Peculiar Pakistani Family. If you Google Usman T. Malik and The Vaporization Enthalpy of a Peculiar Pakistani Family, it will come up, and it's free to read online. It's a story about love in the time of drones in Waziristan and Pakistan. And it's, you know, it sounds like something that would, when I say it like that, it sounds like something that would be in, you know, an article in the New York Times or in Newsweek or something of that sort. But it's, he writes kind of this, he writes weird fiction. He writes this kind of Lovecraftian horror, which just works really well for the kind of horrors that people sort of face when they are faced with daily drone attacks. It's fantastic. I mean, I couldn't recommend it more highly.
Man. That sounds really good.
It is. He's turned out suddenly this guy, and he's writing this stuff. And I mean, there are very few people writing this kind of stuff in Pakistan. First of all, there aren't that many people writing literature in English anyway. There are people who are being published. To me, it seems like one of those people who grew up wanting to do this, and then when he had the chance to be outside of Pakistan and make that effort to have his skill honed. I mean, he went to Clarion and was trained by people. I think it was Samuel Delaney and Neil Gaiman, people like that. And I think he sold a novella to Tor next year as well. So he's well on his way. And there might have been some talk, some stuff I read about him and possibly a Nebula nomination for his short stories. But really, this story is really, really good.
Well, I have a feeling that we could probably go on about books for like another hour or so, but I think Jared probably has to get to work at some point today.
I should at least shower.
I would hate to send you to work without a shower because you were recording Rocket Talk.
So that would be really tough to explain to my clients. Yes.
So do you have any other books that you feel compelled to expound on, Jared, or are you ready to call it a day?
I have a million books that I would be very happy to expound on. Let me sneak in one more. It's an anthology, Feast, Potluck, and Famine. It's the anthology of last year's Short Story Day Africa winners. It's free-ranging across literature and science fiction and fantasy and all sorts of things around the theme of food. But it's, I think, about 18 authors from all across Africa. It's beautifully written, completely diverse in how the stories address the theme of food, and it has some absolutely cracking stories in there.
On the theme of fiction from another part of the world, or referencing another part of the world, my last one that I'll recommend is The Three Body Problem by Liu Cixin, and translated by Ken Liu, and it's like proper hard science fiction that's couched within historical fiction of the communist era. I shouldn't say communist era China. That doesn't really tell you much, does it? Of Cultural Revolution era China, and begins there and then progresses to the modern day. And it's an alien invasion story with virtual reality and paragraph after paragraph about celestial bodies and how they interact with one another. But it is proper hard science fiction, but done in a way through a totally different viewpoint than our hard science fiction. I mean, even though it's obviously influenced by, you know, the Clark and Asimov and those kinds of things, it's also told from the perspective of a Chinese writer, which we're just now starting to get those kinds of perspectives translated into English. And I'm very excited about it. And I want to make sure that people go out there and buy it, because I want to see more of it.
There's actually, I absolutely love his work, I think it's one of the first review copies I ever got as a blogger was I think a cultural institute that was translating his short stories got in touch, and so there's actually quite a wealth of his work online as ebooks on sort of various Amazon platforms, and every one of those stories is exactly as you say, just science fiction, but from almost golden age science fiction, but from a very different perspective. And so it's almost like approaching the golden age from a from a fresh viewpoint, completely anew.
And I feel like as a science fiction and fantasy reader, like that's what's so exciting about starting to see fiction coming to the U.S. from other places. I mean, we've been exporting our fiction everywhere, you know, and Mavesh talks about reading Dragonlance or reading Banks or whatever. And those were going, we've been exporting them for decades, but it's finally starting to seem like it's coming the other way now. And like, I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. I completely agree. And Mavesh has been very nice about crediting us for teaching her authors, but it's been working both ways. And Mavesh has been teaching me about the beauty that is Urdu pulp. And there's just so much wonderful, wonderful books that, you know, we never get. And I'm so glad that the world is getting, as they say, smaller. So we can start reading all of the Dragonlances of the world.
Amen. Mavesh, I would give you one more book to recommend, except you have your own podcast debuting on December 5th. And I don't want to steal any more of your thunder.
No, wait, I want to mention two more books, though. We haven't, neither of us, neither Jared or I. Too bad, I'm here and I'm going to say something. None of us brought up Cameron Hurley's The Mirror Empire, which I liked a great deal. And I thought was very, very interesting. I'm looking forward to the rest of it. Also, Lauren Bucus's Broken Monsters is one of the things I highly enjoyed this year. So I wanted to mention that quickly as well.
Yeah, no, Cameron did all kinds of interesting things in there. And I got to mention The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison is another book that I absolutely adored and will be recommending for a lot of awards this year. So I've never read Lauren Bucus's newer stuff. I haven't read Broken Monsters and I haven't read The Shining Girls. I tried to read The Shining Girls, but I was so disturbed by the opening chapter. I couldn't.
Oh, it was one of my favorite books of that year.
I know. Jared liked it too, I think.
I really liked it, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a fan. I have to be honest. I mean, and full disclosure, I like a lot of her stuff all the time. She wrote a story for a magazine. I forget, it was called 12 Tomorrows, I think. It was put out by MIT, the university. And she said it in Karachi, and we had a very long conversation about what Karachi was like and how she could set the story there. So it was fascinating for me to see a writer from a whole different part of the world being able to imagine what I was telling her into fiction. It was amazing. It was a really amazing process.
Well, I suspect that anybody that tunes into Midnight in Karachi will perhaps hear some of that same stuff that you told Lauren might come through in the podcast from time to time.
Oh, God. Yes, it might. Although it's been amazing. You haven't heard. Have you heard any buses or rickshaws or anything? My soundproofing might have worked.
I'm really disappointed. You kind of.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I could leave the door open next time.
We'll have to work on that. So Midnight in Karachi debuts on, am I correct in saying December 5th?
I think so, yeah.
All right. We're looking forward to it. Jared, thanks for being here, and everybody should check out One Comic Podcast and all your other stuff, too.
Excellent, thanks.
This has been Rocket Talk.